Governor Holcomb unveils his 2018 agenda. A growing battle over medical marijuana. That, plus tax reform brings Mike Pence back home again to Indiana. And more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 10th, 2017.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb unveiled his 2018 agenda, which includes a new layer of bureaucracy to address ongoing workforce needs. Holcomb's initiative follows in the footsteps of several previous governors who've tried to match what's taught in schools and training programs with what employers need at their businesses. Holcomb says the new iteration will be locally focused, with leaders at the regional, county, and community level driving decision-making. With that comes a new state government group, the Education to Career Pathway Cabinet. It will be led by Secretary of Career Connections Blair Milo and include leaders from several state agencies and the General Assembly. They will spend the next year helping establish the local groups to focus on workforce alignment. Holcomb says he will empower the new cabinet to shape programming and direct funding across the state. Is this edition of Workforce Alignment the one that finally works? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwann is the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Ketzenberger. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, governors of both parties have tried versions of this. Is this the breakthrough?
No. How's that? I mean, what's the definition of insanity? We've gone through this before, doing the same thing over and over again. What he's trying to do here, I mean, in order for this to work, to actually, first of all, forecast what the jobs are going to be in the future, which, you know, without a crystal ball may be a little tough, even with whatever programs they have. And then they want to, I guess, gear education to that so that the employer doesn't have to spend any money and all the state picks up all the expenses of training whatever workers we think we're going to need in the future. What you're talking about is the education system, okay? And you're talking about having the governor basically take it over in a different way than Mike Pence tried to do. And he's doing that all without any resources behind it, okay? If we need more teachers for informatics, or we need more computer teachers, or we need more welders, or whatever it is that we think we need for the future, that takes education, and that takes money. And instead of tearing the teachers down and not providing the resources for them to do their job as they are capable of doing, and probably nobody on this group is an educator, they're probably not capable. They're going to mandate something down to the schools again, and they're not going to provide the resources to do it. So if you're serious about it, instead of looking like you're doing something about the fact that our income continues to lag behind the national income, which, of course, as Mitch Daniels said, was the only measure of gubernatorial success, after 13 years, we're in a deeper hole than we were when they took over. So if you want to do something about what we're teaching, what we need to do is invest in teachers and give them the resources to do it and stop mandating these things and creating commissions that make people on the commission feel good but do nothing.
I'm guessing you have a different view, Mike O'Brien.
I have good news. So rather than mandate from the top down, as Ann said, which is what we have done to a large degree, there's been commissions and for five governors in a row have tried this. One, we shouldn't stop, even though Ann thinks it's insane. So we shouldn't just stop and say, well, we're not really going to invest in training young people or having young people identify what they want to do and link them up in their community or train them to do that or improve the education system around that, what the next job is. I think the biggest change you're going to see from this, it's what we've learned from the regional cities exercise, is that local businesses and community leaders and educators and school corporations can come together in a region that's defined by them and identify a project that will, or a series of projects over time that will be funded by the state if they're selected and they fit all the criteria, that will invest in the community. So they're going to take that model and apply it to this. Start from the bottom up. We're not going to just, there's not going to be any top-down mandate. They're going to look at the local level, local business leaders, local communities, local school corporations, and employers, because government doesn't know what the jobs of the future are. The guys who are creating the jobs of the future do, and they know that they need a trained workforce. And I think the biggest difference right now is we have record job commitments at record average incomes. And so we do need to go find the workforce and train them up.
I want to ask about this idea of it's locally driven. And Mike, you referenced the Regional Cities Initiative. That was also referenced by the governor. But the Regional Cities Initiative came with a $40 million carrot for these regions to form together. Without that $40 million carrot, do we really expect locals to get along?
It may be a tall order. Money does have a way of smoothing over some of the animosities and rough edges. But I guess I would point out that just as Ann suggested, we have had any number of remodels, if you will, of our state's workforce development efforts back to Evan Bayh's administration and beyond. We should point out that the notion of local input and local level decision making is not altogether new either. If you look back at and it's a long list, if you put together all of the entities created at the state and local level since let's go to the Bayh administration, or let's go back to the Orr administration, when really economic development and the notion of being a global competitor really took off, you could fill a very long list. And a lot of those were, at least in theory, locally based, locally focused. So it's not without precedent. It is a bit of sense of deja vu here. One would hope that this gets traction. But then again, one would also question whether some of the measures that were already in place were given sufficient time to yield bear fruit. For instance, you have the Commission on Higher Education, which had been working very closely with economic development entities within state government to try to target these very skill sets that were needed, and have set up an apparatus with schools, existing schools in the state,
They will be folded into this
cabinet. But if you throw everything out, that would be a disappointment. If you use that infrastructure and the successes that have been made and the plans that have already been made and incorporated into it, well, then I guess there's some value in that.
Or do we really expect the locals to be able to group together in the way that we want them to?
You know, I'm not sure I see it quite the same way. I think that this is a statewide effort. It has to be a statewide effort with the local participation. It's interesting because at the turn of the 20th century, we saw the change from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy. And Indiana adjusted to that change, and workers were produced that allowed them to take those jobs. And they were very different from many of the jobs that they had before. And one of the key ingredients was that there was a common school system that taught basic knowledge, and then that basic knowledge was picked up and then enhanced by either higher education, a vocational education, or training provided by employers. And it's a very simple model, but that's what I see they're trying to come back to. Now, yes, it's a bureaucracy, and yes, you've got politics in play, and yes, it is a different era. We're entering from an industrial era to the digital, or going well into the digital era now. So the transition's different, but the principles are the same, and it requires a good common education that then can be enhanced through means such as vocational education, because a lot of the jobs that you talked about that are going unfilled don't require a college degree, but they may require certification. Yeah. So that's the key.
But there are some differences between the transition from
agricultural. I grant that completely.
But part of it is, though, that we no longer regard education and teachers with the same kind of on the same kind of pedestal that we used to. We don't long compensate them the way they should have been. And the unions have been demoralized as well. And they provided a very important part of the skilled labor education process through the apprenticeship program, and in many cases, that's gone.
My wife's a teacher, and she is still on a pedestal and always will be.
Well, you better make sure she stays there.
Governor Holcomb took a stand this week on a growing push toward decriminalizing medical marijuana.
Efforts to decriminalize marijuana for medical purposes have ramped up this year, with Republican State Representative Jim Lucas pledging to explore a medical marijuana bill and groups like the American Legion backing the push. But the Indiana Prosecuting Attorney's Council and Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill have loudly denounced such a move, and Holcomb says the state isn't ready to decriminalize marijuana for any purpose. The Indiana Commission to Combat Drug Abuse backed up the governor, approving a resolution that resists any further move to decriminalize marijuana.
Mike O'Brien, as more states opt into the medical marijuana route, is Indiana behind the times?
I think you've seen states evolve in this direction predictably. More liberal states that have more, the eight states that have recreational marijuana, for example, are Democrat states that all approved it by voter referendum and have that process that they kind of default to. So that was expected. There's been 29 states that have adopted some form of medical marijuana. Indiana scratched the surface on this last year by allowing for resistant therapies for epilepsy, cannabis oil, and low-level THC. So there are several states that have done that as well. So each state's kind of taken this in their own at their own speed and with their own demand. I agree with Governor Holcomb, though. In the if you look at the broader context of how we talk about drugs right now, it's difficult to fight, and I know they're not. I know you can make the argument that they're not related, but it is very difficult to make the case that we need to expand into medical marijuana and dispensaries and a distribution process for legalized marijuana, even if it's only applicable in that medical case. At the same time, you're really trying to. He announced his agenda this week, which again, in part and necessarily, has to attack the addiction epidemic that's not just hitting Indiana; it's hitting the whole country. I know you can make the policy case that those aren't connected, or a medical case that those aren't, scientific case that those are not necessarily connected. They're certainly connected in terms of just the effort we put in.
So it's a perception.
It's a real perception problem right now.
Without the scourge of the drug epidemic that Indiana has struggled with for years now, does that change the conversation? Is it that really is going to stop the sort of trend we might have seen going forward?
I think we're going to see the trend going forward anyway. I mean, I understand the argument you're making, and on one level they make sense. But if you're facing an end-of-life situation with somebody in extreme discomfort and pain, it is very hard to say that there's something here that you could use that could make the quality of your life for your remaining days better, but we're not going to have it because there's a policy war at work here, and we want to make sure the perceptions are correct. I mean, when you see somebody who is dying, and that's what this is used for largely, it's very, very hard not to be sympathetic that should be available to them.
Is it, though, the drug epidemic that, I mean, you have folks who push for medical marijuana who say the drug epidemic is precisely why you need it, because it's an alternative to prescription opioids that are an actual gateway into heroin and meth?
That's the summary of the arguments that have been made. You know, this gateway notion of gateway drugs, especially when you're talking about the opioids, I don't know that plays quite the same, because you know, a lot of those drugs are, while obtained on the gray or black market, originate through prescriptions and that kind of thing. You know, you're talking about tightly regulating it like you would anything else. The regulation hasn't worked so well in the opioid situation because it hasn't been well regulated. I think that's one of the critical factors here. And I think Ann's case, you know, about the need for it in cases where people are dying and it does provide a better quality of life, eventually will carry the day along with all of the others. But I think, you know, it's an interesting situation filled with a lot of emotion.
So eventually, we see this trend going in this direction. Obviously, Governor Holcomb has put his foot down, and I don't think that spells good things for the 2018 session. But in the next 5 years, is this trend going to be too difficult to push against?
Probably. I mean, if your initial question was, are we out of sync as a state, you don't leave all the philosophy and the politics aside. If 29 states have it, that's a majority. Yes, by definition, we are out of sync. I think you also have to look at the representation or the makeup of the legislature. Yes, it's been Republican control in the past, and it is now. But there's some different. It's a different flavor of Republicanism. This seems to be, as we've seen with Representative Jim Lucas and others, more of a libertarian streak,
yeah.
And as opposed to, let's, for lack of a better term, describe as the traditional establishment wing of the party. So I think that coupled with this movement, this growing trend, and the emergence, it seems, while not by the FDA, at least some federal agencies that have looked at the scientific and medical benefits have said that, well, granted, we would require an FDA review first, right, there do seem to be some benefits. So,
and that is to, and that is what Governor Holcomb said too, is if you really want to have this fight, you should have it at
right,
the FDA.
Right.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, is Governor Holcomb right to resist any effort to decriminalize marijuana, even for medical reasons? A yes or B, no. Last week's question, should the University of Notre Dame be compelled to cover birth control? Apparently they were listening. 64% said yes, 36% said no, and Notre Dame this week opted to continue providing birth control coverage for its employees. If you would like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Vice President Pence made another policy stop in Indiana this week as the White House continues its push for tax reform.
It's the second such visit Pence has made to his home state within a month to stump for federal tax reform. It's part of a push by national Republicans to put pressure on Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly over the issue. Donnelly has not yet taken a position on the tax reform plan, which is still being rolled out and is currently in the U.S. House. And polling released this week from the Bowen Center's Hoosier Survey shows a majority of Hoosiers are most concerned about what they view as corporations and the wealthy not paying their fair share in taxes.
John Katzenberger, in a Republican state like Indiana, is Pence's presence here an effective one as part of this national push for tax reform?
I think it is interesting you see the dichotomy between the poll and the plan that the House Republicans and the president put forward. We've seen the Senate's plan now. There are some marked differences between the two. And whatever the reconciliation between them is, I think will be far different in the end. So to answer your question, no.
he clearly this is an effort to put pressure on Joe Donnelly, but is it more about the tax reform vote or is it more about 2018's election?
A little bit of both, but probably the vision is more toward 2018. And I do think that the luster is wearing off a bit in terms of the White House, the current administration, as the holy grail for Republican candidates who simply want to attach themselves to that juggernaut and think that that will have the same benefits perhaps that it did last time voters went to the in a presidential contest went to the voting, the polls, or in this case a midterm election. So because we are seeing an erosion of support, both in terms of what most polls, including as we've discussed Fox News's poll, has shown an erosion in support for the Trump administration and for therefore presumably for Mike Pence. And as we see more of the dissection, if you will, in Washington of the tax reform plan and the fact that, you know, could it hurt charitable groups? Could it hurt those who receive mortgage deductions? Those people are starting to say, well, maybe it's not the panacea. And I do think John's right. We'll see something dramatically different, in which case a lot of the pressure does start to, for all the reasons articulated, starts to come off of Joe Donnelly's shoulders.
To that point, Joe Donnelly he meets with President Trump for dinner at the White House. He meets with his economic advisor to talk about this. He rode with him in the car when Donald Trump came here. So on the one hand, Joe Donnelly is working with the White House on tax reform. On the other hand, you have Donald Trump and then now Mike Pence calling him out in speeches saying, you've got to vote for this. Reconcile those two things for me.
One, I think Joe Donnelly's doing the smart political thing and he's playing ball with Republicans. And at the end of the day, it's going to be the risk that Republicans run is that we cannot pass it at the end of the day. Now there are going to continue to be different variations of this bill. They are going to find a balance between passing a fiscally responsible tax reform package and the right mix of simplification, the elimination of deductions, and the simplification that 90% of Americans can fill out their taxes on one sheet of paper and simplify this. And to do that, you're going to have to eliminate some of these deductions, some of these complicating factors in the these nuances in the tax code. But at the end of the day, if Republicans cannot pass this, it's going to be, and Republicans need to pay attention, it is going to be really easy for Joe Donnelly to come back here and say, hey, I opposed it for the same reason all those Republicans opposed it, which is why it didn't pass. I think ultimately it'll still pass. Ultimately, I think Joe Donnelly is still going to have to support it at the end of the day. I don't think he's going to have a choice but to support tax reform.
Will Joe Donnelly have to support tax reform?
We don't even know what it is, okay? I mean, talk about a moving mosaic. At the moment, the House bill benefits billionaires. How many of those are there in Plainfield, by the way? I mean, sure. Seriously.
Other than Avon.
Other than you. Okay, that's good.
Avon, Plainfield.
But my point is, this is skewed. The crumbs that come to the middle class, the crumbs of tax cuts that come to the middle class all expire. And at the end of the expiration date, they're going to be paying more in taxes, not less. Okay? And meanwhile, if you take out the alternative minimum tax and the estate tax and the other things that they're talking about doing, lowering, the most amazing thing is if you benefit from a small corporation, okay, but you don't work for it, you just benefit from it, like Donald Jr. or Little Trump, whatever his name is, when you get that money coming in, you will pay 25% on that. If you work for that corporation, you'd pay the 40%. I mean, what is fair about that? Passive income is being rewarded. I mean, how many times? That's what brought the England down, for crying out loud. You work for your money, you pay a fair tax for it, okay? You don't get to keep it forever.
It does seem to me just that if you're a Republican, and as you look specifically, let's say, at the House plan, which we've had more time to let bake and examine, Republicans, it seems to me, would have two concerns. One, as Mike suggests, that it doesn't pass. And the other concern, it seems to me, is that it does pass.
Yeah.
Because there are, I think there would be some significant blowback, if not immediately, certainly over time, as people start to realize, wait, why did this go away? Why am I no longer able to do this? And I think there's some long-term political consequences.
You don't get to keep your money forever should be like the slogan of the Democratic Party.
No, you don't keep the money that your daddy handed down to you forever at a lower tax rate.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions met with the Indianapolis 10-Point Coalition this week, drawing a mixed reaction from folks in the community.
10 Point is known for its street-level engagement, particularly through safety patrols in high-crime areas. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, who also attended the meeting with Sessions, announced earlier this year his office would lead efforts to spread the coalition to communities around the state. Attorney General Sessions said in his opening remarks before the meeting, 10 Point's approach could be a model for much-needed work across the country. But black pastors from Indianapolis aren't happy about the meeting with Sessions, arguing the attorney general works against the interests of the African-American community.
John Schwannis, if you're 10 Point, is it in your best interest, considering your reliance on fostering the best relationship with the African-American community, is it in your best interest to meet with such a divisive figure in that community like Jeff Sessions?
Well, certainly there's a risk of alienating some of the core supporters, but if you look at the 10-Point Coalition, where it exists and where it does have its people on the ground, these, you know, reformed gangbangers who are now sort of the teaching young people and forging alliances that show them there is a better way that doesn't involve incarceration or death, they have an impact. But they can't be everywhere in all of the areas that are troubled by high homicide rates and gang violence. So it seems to me that what are you left with then? You're left with the proposition that you need to broaden the coalition and broaden the base and the funding sources. So you look at, for instance, with Curtis Hill, whose organization, the Attorney General's office, has tried to push it out and put, I think, what, $500,000 behind it. You look at the same thing with the federal government. Presumably the Justice Department would have dollars and funds that it could also put toward this cause. So I think the Reverend Charles Harrison summed it up best. He's the president of 10 Point organization here, and he said, you know, look at what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. did. He met with, during the height of the strife surrounding the war, the civil rights movement, he met with unsavory characters.
He wasn't trying to get money from them, though, and that's the difference.
But isn't that the point, though? Jeff Sessions has his hands on at least some of the purse strings and might be able to send some dollars their way.
Absolutely. If you're the 10-Point Coalition and you want to take your model national, then you do meet with the Attorney General, because that is where the money flows from. As we've seen in Indiana, the $500,000 that the Attorney General here has earmarked for the 10-Point Coalition. But it is a divisive question, and there are a lot of folks in the black community in Indianapolis who are not convinced that the 10-Point Coalition's approach is the right approach either. This is a tough, tough question. There's no doubt that involvement in all communities, all neighborhoods, ensures that crime is reduced. When people are paying attention to what's going around them, then you have less crime. But the approach that you take to that, it matters, and there are very, very different views of how that's done.
Quickly, if you're Charles Harrison, is the benefit of potential funding that Jeff Sessions might steer your way outweigh any damage you do in your community? by meeting with him?
It's obviously divisive. It's going to do him some damage by meeting with him. I hope when he was meeting with him, he also raised the voter suppression and the Black Lives Matter so that you can talk about why he is such a divisive figure and see whether the Attorney General is prepared to deal with the attempts to suppress the Black vote as well as too much police violence against Blacks.
Do you think this was the right move if you're Charles Harrison?
I think it is. But I mean, your alternative is, look, you've had the White House, regardless of what party or what you think of these people individually, you've had the White House look at what the example here and say, how do we replicate that all over the country? And you send the Attorney General here. Now, if you're in the 10-point coalition, you either say, look, we're just taking 4 years off, and if we have a Democrat president in 2021, right, we'll see you then.
Finally, Governor Holcomb's 2018 agenda this week includes his support of a Lafayette student group's years-long push to make the Say's Firefly the state insect. Mike O'Brien, after years of lawmakers blocking this proposal, will Holcomb's support help ensure this issue doesn't bug them much longer?
It's terrible.
That is just terrible.
It lights up the room.
I didn't come prepared with my own pun. I think they'll just roll it into Sunday sales. And we'll just
like everything comes down to money. And you look at the cockroach lobby, that thing is huge.
I think that's just the lobby, right? That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes of Indiana Lawmakers, and political analyst John Katzenberger. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.